to ask you to let your friends and family and colleagues throughout the world know about Taking AIM. We, for instance, are in California, and we listen to WBAI on the Internet. So it is possible to share with people around the world, because remember, we are the many, and they are the few. And the only thing that keeps them in power is our ineffective organization. If we can get together and organize in our workplace through our unions, in our communities through our community organizations, and through the development of our own political instruments, what we're talking about today will be a matter of history, and we can reconstruct the world in our own best interests.
Actually, the assumption has often been made that the people of the United States are supportive of the two parties of corporate capital, the one big property party with two names. But actually, the New York Times reported in the last election that 84% of the American people repudiate or reject the two political parties, the Republican and Democratic Party. How is that possible? Because in reality, in a national election, approximately 48 or 49% of the registered voters participate. But the registered voters are but a fraction of the eligible electorate, sometimes as little as half of the eligible electorate. That means in reality that it's 24% holding their nose while they cut their vote between the two parties, and you're talking then about 12% for each. But in the primary process, when there's a multiplicity of potential nominees, the turnout is about 19%. And when you realize that that's about half of the eligible electorate, because that 19% is of the registered voters, and you cut that between the two parties, you're talking about roughly 5%. And with a multiplicity of these candidates, these fakers are getting half of 1%, 1% of the eligible electorate. When they are achieving office. Office, I want to emphasize, that is without power, because they are nominal representatives. They represent no one but those who finance them and put them into play as public relations operatives of that very concentrated structure of power, which we are continuing to document and describe for this audience, for our brothers and sisters. And so we have to look at this and ask the question, are people indifferent? No, they are not. Are they stupid? They certainly are not. Are they ignorant? No, they are not. It's that there's nothing out there for them. Working people look at this array of politicians and they conclude they're all crooks. One gets into office and nothing changes. If another gets into office, it's the same old, same old. So what we're dealing with here is the inability of people to find a political expression. There's a sleeping giant out there, brothers and sisters. Working people in this United States understand clearly that this system and these political parties have vanishing little interest in their ongoing needs. Our task, our opportunity, our responsibility is to bring information, to deploy it as an instrument of organization, and to create the political alternatives to the parties of capital.
Last week, we talked about bioterrorism, and in particular, we addressed the bioterrorism that has been used against the American people, and in particular, the soldiers who are sent off as cannon fodder to fight in the interests of the corporate few. Among these were the Gulf War veterans. Over half a million soldiers have been inoculated with anthrax vaccine, vaccines against cholera, and many other potential bioterrorist attacks, none of which have been documented that these vaccines are actually going to be effective against any such attacks. And of these, 88,000 of the U.S. Gulf War veterans are complaining of illnesses, very severe illnesses, some of the veterans have died. And what, as a result of the vaccines and also their exposure to depleted uranium, over 300 tons were blown up through the armaments, because most armaments used today have depleted uranium, and once it explodes and it goes on fire, the depleted uranium is released into the atmosphere. Chemical weapons, pesticides, and again, as I said, the vaccines, the experimental drugs. Not only are the Gulf War veterans facing debilitating illnesses, as many as 50 to 70% of the spouses of the ill veterans are ill themselves, and 25 to 50% of the veterans' children are sick or have birth defects. One of the people who heard our program contacted and spoke to Ralph and said that it's not just the Gulf War, that his father had been a victim of testing that had gone on in years past, in particular in Alabama at Camp Silbert. And he sent us information that we'd like to share with you. He also told us about rats, the Registry of Atmospheric Testing Survivors. And just like the Gulf War veterans have a wonderful website that leads you to a lot of information about the anthrax vaccine and the testing that is done on soldiers, RATS also has a lot of information at their website that will be useful to you in understanding more of the government campaign against the people of the United States and people of the world.
And as we discussed in detail in our last program, biological warfare and the instrument of biological terror has been a principal weapon in the arsenal of imperialism and capitalism for a period of 200 years. The war in Vietnam was characterized by the relentless use of biological agents against the mass of the Vietnamese people. We're talking about gases that explode the pupil of the eye, a series of bacteriological agents, including plague bacteria, which the Bertrand Russell International Tribunal on U.S. war crimes in Vietnam documented extensively. And indeed, this was the pattern of use in the Gulf War, and we documented it, as you may recall, in our program last week, the devastating consequence of the introduction of biological agents, which have created thalidomide birth deformities on an epidemic scale throughout Iraq, the introduction of parasites such as the old world screwworm that have devastated 7 million livestock, the presence of viruses and bacteria that were never before extant in the region until the U.S. produced them and introduced them and deployed them as weapons. But this is but an expression of what the U.S. government has done, and the Pentagon in particular, against citizens in the United States, as we documented in the discussions of Clouds of Secrecy.
Going back to Camp Siebert, in the spring of 1942, they developed in Alabama the Replacement Training Center, it was called, an innocuous name for what was really the Army's Chemical Warfare Service. And they set up training areas and used the soldiers to test many of their weaponry and the vaccines, etc. So training areas were constructed to resemble Japanese pillboxes, and the government just sent people out into these areas, and afterwards the land, which had been spread with various gases, chemical weapons, and so forth, went through minor decontamination, and the toxic areas in were later handed over to the Gadsden Municipal Airport and the city of Gadsden. And this people are now living in single-family housing and their industrial facilities right on the area where Camp Siebert had done all this biological testing. And as well, besides Camp Siebert, the biggest of the government testing areas, as we mentioned last week and I'll go into again, is in Utah, because many people don't realize how much of the United States is actually federal land. And Dugway, which is 80 miles from Salt Lake City, is larger than the state of Rhode Island. Imagine, the Army's proving ground where it tests weapons and does a lot of its secret chemical and biological warfare experiments is on U.S. territory, larger than the state of Rhode Island and off limits to any scrutiny. So far, there's been documentation of 1,635 field trials or demonstrations with nerve agents such as VX, GA, and GB, and that was between 1951 and 1969, although we know that these chemical tests still go on, as we revealed last week.
In fact, in the two works by the noted public health official Leonard Cole, who had worked at Fort Detrick, over a period of 40 years, the Pentagon has utilized trillions of bacilli and spores in cities across the United States. As New York Times acknowledged, that 239 sites in the United States, the subway systems of New York, the school systems of St. Louis and Minneapolis, above all in the Bay Area, San Francisco, where trillions of bacilli caused the tenfold increase in spinal and brain meningitis.
Well, Dr. Cole is to this day still giving testimony because the Army contends that this bacilli, which caused encephalitis, is really a harmful dispersal. Harmless dispersal agents that they use to test the effect that potential biological terror weapons would have on the United States. And what Dr. Cole has demonstrated again and again is that these are not harmless agents. Aside from the supposed harmless agents, which have been documented as harmful, the government has been doing these nerve agent weaponry tests at Dugway, and they had over 400 demonstrations that they used on visiting soldiers, particularly officers, to give them experience. And one way this became known was that in about all this biological testing was that when they fly over Dugway, they hope to locate the spots that they've targeted for their test, but that in 1968, on May 13th, 1968, the plane dropped its load outside of Dugway at a place called Skull Valley, and the 6,000 sheep began dying downwind of this drop, and eventually, although everything stayed in under secrecy, $1 million was paid to the farmer, and Ray Peck, who was the rancher who lived there, and it was his family, developed nervous system illness for years afterwards, and as well as having all the sheep, his sheep destroyed.
Well, actually, as we know, the number of people in the United States that Leonard Cole documents in Clouds of Secrecy who have been affected, it includes systemic illness, deaths, and a total compromise of their central nervous systems and health, have been over 10 million people, civilians in the United States, and this concentrated in working class sectors of cities, notably in black communities. But above all, this has been a sustained and ongoing and continuing program. In fact, in 1994, the Rockefeller Report on biological experimentation on the U.S. military, that is to say on U.S. military personnel and by the U.S. military on civilian personnel, entailed mustard gas and Lewisite radiation exposure. And the documentation in this remarkable Rockefeller report is that for 50 years, the Department of Defense intentionally exposed populations to dangerous substances in secret, failed to comply with any standards to preserve or protect the lives of human subjects, and I'm quoting from the finding and conclusions, and incorrectly claimed that their goal was treatment or preventive use. let's be very clear about this. This entire pretext and rationale of the U.S. Rulers and the military that these across the nation testing of deadly biological agents had anything to do with something called defense is a facade and a lie acknowledged here by the Rockefeller Report. Indeed, our civilian population are targeted in precisely the way that the civilian populations of Vietnam, of Iraq, of Afghanistan, of Somalia, of Angola, of Mozambique, of other victim societies that the U.S. military and the U.S. rulers have sought to wage war upon and to dominate and control. Because our rulers, above all, are concerned about the potential of resistance and rebellion and of opposition in the form of a bid for power from the vast majority of the citizens who they exploit and over whom they rule. The Department of Defense utilized, again I'm quoting from the Rockefeller Report, pyridostigmine bromide without any indication that it would be tolerable by civilians or by U.S. troops. They had no evidence that it was safe, and of course, on the contrary, it is not just not safe, it is deployable as a weapon in and of itself. The botulism vaccine, like the anthrax vaccine, which was imposed upon military personnel, caused devastating health effects. And again, these have been documented by veterans organizations, including the Gulf War Veterans Association. Again, during the last 50 years, according to the Rockefeller Report, the military have inflicted biological and chemical weapons, and I'm quoting, and dangerous substances on not only U.S. troops, but on the civilian population. And it was deployed as a protocol with the cover of protecting these populations against chemical warfare, but in fact utilizing them as targets for the weapons themselves. The Army Center for Technical Services, the U.S. Army Center for Technical Services, has a list of the types of weapons that they deploy and that they stockpile and that they have prepared for use and which indeed have been used. Nerve Agent GA. A nerve agent that is clear, colorless, and tasteless, and is chemically similar to organophosphate pesticides such as malathion or parathion, but with devastating effect. The toxic properties of nerve agent GA are acknowledged by the U.S. Army Center for Technical Services. Other such agents include blood agent hydrogen cyanide, psychedelic agent 3, kinulisidol benzoate, choking agent phosgene, blood agent cyanogen chloride, agent chloroacetophenone benzene, carbon tetrachloride. These are weapons that have been used and weapons that are deployed and weapons that are stockpiled. Again, a list. Phosphine coxine, atomsite, nerve agents GA, GB, and GD, agents H and D for mustard agents, nitrogen mustard, HN1, nitrogen mustard, HN2, HN3, nerve agent VX, white phosphorus WP. This is an arsenal for biological warfare that has repeatedly been the weapons of choice of our rulers. And now the population of this country is being terrorized with a constant specter of biological warfare when the principal purveyor of these weapons is the U.S. government itself.
Let's look at how the Army used the farmers that it hired at the Dugway Proving Ground, because Dugway provided the few jobs in the area for people, and also the soldiers who were sometimes given nominal leave, or a few days leave, or were paid a little extra money. For instance, they would set out and create grids, and then they would release mosquitoes that were carrying encephalitis. Other workers would be contaminated when they were dealing with animal experiments. Instead of using humans, they did tests on guinea pigs, rabbits, dogs, horses, cows, monkeys, and even antelope. And these animals were killed, you know, in great mass with all these experiments of nerve gas and, as Ralph said, BX, all these other chemicals, and also things such as encephalitis. All totaled, it's been shown that there's 500,000 pounds of nerve agent was released into the open wind at Dugway, and we know that anybody who lives in any area knows that air carries it very far, and this 500,000 pounds of nerve agent is equivalent to 3.5 trillion lethal doses. The Army drug tested 28 pounds of the highly harmless VX nerve, harmful, excuse me, folks, today I have a very bad cold, VX agent. And sometimes the ammunition containing the nerve agent didn't explode. And the Department of Interior did a study, and they claim that 1,400 square miles of public land in Utah is still covered with unexploded ordnance, some of it containing nerve agents and germ warfare.
I think we should take a moment and think through what this data represents. 3.5 trillion lethal doses of nerve gas released into the atmosphere that permeates the aquifer through rainfall, that gets into the soil and into the food chain, that enters very easily mucous membrane and the placenta, that has been generalized now, not just in Dugway and in Utah, but by the normal workings of air currents in the environment in the United States, and in particular because the biological agents that are described in Clouds of Secrecy and in the 11th Plague have been deployed throughout the continental United States. But one other thing that should be pointed out, the current company that we're going to discuss in some detail later on in this program, namely Bioport, that has a monopoly over anthrax vaccine and has in fact been responsible for the vaccination with devastating effects of over 500,000 soldiers, and with the instant demand that 2.6 million U.S. military personnel should be subjected to this. This company, whose chairman is former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral William J. Crow, has been revealed to have been responsible, namely William J. Crow, for insisting during the Iraq-Iran war that the regime of Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi government deploy anthrax germs against Iran, now released and documented. William Crow was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff from 1985 until he retired from the Navy in 1989. So indeed, when we talk about the presence or the use of biological agents by the Iraqi regime, they were supplied by the United States, they were insisted upon by the United States, they were designed for the use against civilian populations in Iran as part of the response of U.S. imperialism to the Iranian revolution. We'll come back to the structure of the Bioport company and its relationship to the Carlyle Group at a later point.
But before we do that, Ralph, to continue about testing that is done on soldiers and the testing of chemical weapons, it's not just in the United States that this is done. In England, at Porton Down, which we'll discuss in more detail because of the relationship between Porton Down to the anthrax, the company Bioport, and its relationship to the anthrax vaccine and the anthrax terror campaign going on in the United States, which has been documented, by the way, to anthrax having been produced. The anthrax that showed up in Senator Daschle and Senator Leahy's written letters to them and so contaminated the Senate offices leads to federal weapons labs.
Well, actually, it's the 2,300 cases of anthrax since October 1st, which bear the genetic imprint, as the New Scientist documented, notably in the articles by Deborah McKenzie and that of October 24th of last year, that this is has a smoking gun fingerprint. This is weaponized military strains of anthrax produced only in U.S. military labs and with a telltale additive, namely squalene, which was used by the government not only in the attacks, but appears in the nominal vaccine given to the GIs, the soldiers in the Gulf War, which is one of the telltale indicators of the use of this against our own soldiers, which has had the consequence of affecting nearly 100,000 Gulf War veterans.
Now, we have to understand that what we know about the government testing is really only the tip of this iceberg, and we want to thank the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, which in December 1991 wrote an important article on the unfought chemical war, documenting the testing of nerve gas and the proposals to use nerve gas during World War II, and again also rats. And also there's an organization called the Chemical Weapons Working Group, and it's an umbrella organization of grassroots groups that are opposed to chemical incineration. As you know, there are 200 stockpile sites of the munitions and 15,000 toxic dump sites across the country, and various places they've set up these incinerators to try to destroy the toxic waste, which in itself creates toxic clouds in communities across the United States. In Great Britain, comparable to Dubway, but on a much smaller scale in terms of acreage, is Porton Down, which is part of the British Ministry of Defense. It was set up in 1916 at the height of World War I as Britain's secret chemical weapons center, and there's a close relationship between Porton Down and Fort Detrick, and back and forth the transfer of anthrax and other biological weapons. Now, at Porton Down, recently, there's been an expose of testing that was done in 1953. Now, if you can imagine, it's taken this long to get the information out of testing from 1953. It turns out that 1953, there was testing of the nerve agent sarin, which many of you might remember from it having been released in Japan in the subway system and making many people ill.
Yes, and by the way, the cult, as it was called, that was accused of responsibility has long ties to military intelligence, and it is quite evident that the subway systems in Tokyo were a replay of what had been done in the subway systems of New York. What we are witnessing here is a government operation in Japan, no less than in the United States, and with U.S. intelligence closely tied to Japanese intelligence in the effort.
In 1953, a 20-year-old RAF serviceman, Ronald Madison, died shortly after participating in a sarin gas experiment. He was one of six people on that particular day in the who were put into a gas chamber, and they thought that they were volunteers investigating cures for the common cold, when in fact the nerve agent sarin was dripped onto a patch of uniform that had been taped to their arm.
Let's just look at that a moment, because you have the government and the U.S. military and the Pentagon telling U.S. conscripts that they are volunteering or not volunteering. They're being subjected to testing to cure the common cold, and in fact, they are being victimized with nerve gas. What is the nature of a ruling class that is prepared to use and abuse its citizens in this fashion?
Ralph, this was Great Britain, but the same is done in the United States. And it was 200 milligrams of the deadly nerve agent sarin that was dripped on Ronald Madison, and he died within 45 minutes, and there was an inquiry that his father was allowed to attend, but no one was allowed to speak of it. It was all under the Official Secrets Act in Great Britain. But in August 1999, the Wilshire Police, that's the area of Great Britain where Porton Downs is located, began investigating the death of Ronald Madison and also the death of 25 others from that era who had been in these nerve gas trials in the 50s and 60s, and the nerve gas trials continued in the 1980s. And as a result of the publicity of this one case, so many others came forward. About 300 other servicemen came forward, but not just servicemen were subjected to these so-called volunteer experiments. The widow of a welder who worked at Porton Down contacted the police, and all this was reported recently by the BBC. And that's where we got this information. His name was Fred Nyman, and he died at the age of 45, although he was healthy. Now, he didn't volunteer for any experiment. He, in fact, didn't have a choice. He worked at Porton Down as a welder between 1961 and 1966, and he received 19 injections that he was told were immunizations for anthrax, smallpox, polio, and bubonic plague because of the experimentation that was going on at Porton Down, and supposedly he should be in fear of his life, and so he needed these immunizations.
Porton Down, Maya, by the way, was not only the highly secret agency and plant for biological weapons in Great Britain, but it was a testing operation for the U.S. military and the U.S. Pentagon as well. Porton Down was a U.S. British operation right up to and including the time that it would be privatized, and we'll deal with how that came about.
Right. In our second hour, we're going to go into the corporate control. This welder's wife told the BBC that, quote, if he didn't have the injections, her husband would be taken off the job. He'd be downgraded. No injections, no job. That's the simple way to say it. They were guinea pigs. And one day when he came home ill, he said, I've had that bloody American bubonic plague injection. Over 20,000 people, the BBC has documented, were used in experiments at Porton Down. 20,000 people. And all Porton Down would ever admit is that one of their own scientists died in 1962 while he was experimenting with bubonic plague. This revelation has now forced the British government to launch a two-year study of the 20,000 volunteers. But what will come of it? Probably a whitewash. Probably saying, just like the United States was saying about the soldiers who came back and suffered in Vietnam, just as the United States has been saying about the soldiers who've been complaining of all the multiple illnesses, what we call Gulf War syndrome. They will try to sweep it under the rug, because to admit the culpability would be to admit the terror campaign against the people of the world.
Actually, Maya, it's not just a question of it's being swept under the rug. I recall at the time of the Robert Kennedy assassination, when the then coroner in Los Angeles County, Thomas Noguchi, who had done the autopsy on Robert Kennedy, and the autopsy, which was corroborated by the coroner's grand jury, showed that Robert Kennedy was shot from behind at point-blank range, the fatal shot at the right occipital bone, less than a quarter of an inch from the base of the skull. That was seized by the FBI and suppressed, and it was then sent to a few people, Jim Garrison, Dick Gregory, and myself, and we made a desperate effort at the time to get that out. No, none of the media would report it. We did press conference after press conference.
Hi,
black press
the Ralph Shulman, are you there?
Yes,
hi,
hello.
We're about to go to the news.
We're supposed to go to station break.
Yes.
On WBAI 99.5. We will return in 5 minutes with Taking Aim.
Thank you. I'm Paul DiRienzo, and this is WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York City. Ford executives have unveiled a massive restructuring plan that will cut 29,000 jobs in North America. The company also announced it's closing 5 plants in North America and eliminating 4 low-profit vehicles by mid-decade. The plants to be closed are an Edison, New Jersey assembly plant, its Ontario truck plant, the St. Louis assembly plant, Cleveland Aluminum, and Vulcan Forge in Dearborn, Michigan. Ford also plans to eliminate production of the Ford Escort, Mercury Cougar, Mercury Villager, and Lincoln Continental. All told, Ford is eliminating 35,000 jobs worldwide. Ford Chairman and CEO Bill Ford Jr. says those and other moves will deliver $9 billion worth of profit improvement by mid-decade. The plan also includes the suspension of bonuses for company managers and the elimination of 401k matches for employees. For Ford, the need to restructure so severely represents a complete change from a year ago when it reported a profit of more than $6 billion for the year 2000. The United States military spokesperson, a United States military spokesperson, says troops transferring Afghan prisoners to a Navy base in Cuba today know that they're what they're dealing with. And that's his words. He says that Al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters have, quote, vowed to win their way into paradise by murdering anybody in American uniform. An official in Pakistan says some remains have been found at the scenes of Wednesday's crash of a United States military refueling plane carrying 7 Marines. Dozens of Marines and Pakistani troops are involved in the search for the victims in a remote mountainous area. The KC-130 exploded as it slammed into a mountain near an airbase in southwestern Pakistan. Witnesses say 4 U.S. helicopters have been hovering over the area as troops on the ground use sophisticated equipment to search for the charred remains. U.S. officials say there's no indication that the plane was hit by hostile fire, but that the cause of the crash isn't known. President Bush has launched a new federal bid to turn industrial eyesores into fields of opportunity at a corporate technology center in a Philadelphia suburb. Bush signed the so-called Brownfields Bill, setting aside some $250 million a year to clean up and develop an estimated 500,000 sites. And the president's vowing to double funding for the program in next year's budget. It appears Enron played by the rules when it came to managing its 401k plan, at least at first glance. That's what Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill tells ABC. President Bush says he would be willing to pursue a probe into whether the bankrupt energy trading company defrauded investors, including its retirement plan holders. And was he a vicious bully or just a man defending himself? That's the question jurors are again weighing in the trial of Massachusetts hockey dad Thomas Junta, who's accused of manslaughter and the beating death of another father at their kid's practice. Jurors have resumed deliberation this morning after getting the case yesterday. And the White House today expressed ongoing concern about the tense situation between India and Pakistan, with the two nuclear rivals still on the brink of war. Both countries have massed troops on each side of the border in the wake of last month's attack on the Indian parliament that New Delhi blames on guerrillas in Pakistan. Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf, who has condemned the parliament's attack, is due to address its country Saturday in an effort to address bloody sectarian violence and Islamic militancy in his country. Indian Home Minister Lal Krishna Advani, after 2 days of talks with senior U.S. officials, including Bush and Secretary of State Colin Powell, made clear India was waiting for further action from Pakistan. Powell is traveling to India and Pakistan next week to try to encourage the two sides engage in the biggest military buildup in 15 years to pursue diplomatic and political ways to end the dispute. And finally, here in New York City, one day after his formal election, City Council Speaker Gifford Miller had his first power meeting with Mayor Bloomberg yesterday. They chatted for about 20 minutes in the mayor's private office at City Hall, seated in front of a desk that belonged to Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia. The main topic, Miller said, was the city's looming budget deficit for the fiscal year that begins July 1st. The first new leader of the city council in 16 years also began a series of individual meetings with his 50 fellow council members to get a wish list of the committees they would like to head up or to serve on. I'm Paul DiRienzo. It's 39 degrees in New York, going up to the mid-40s. Stay tuned for a continuation of Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen.
Hello, you are back with Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. And this is the second hour of our third show. And we wanted to start the hour by thanking people at WBAI who've made this program possible. I don't know if any of you, or probably some of you, have heard Ralph Schoenman over the years on Alumbe Brath's program, Africa Kaleidoscope.
Yes, and we are particularly grateful to Alumbe for the series of programs on his show that we did in the immediate aftermath of September 11th. And I have to say that in the wake of those shows and the audience response that they elicited, Utrice Lead contacted me and asked if I would be willing to do 2 hours on the meaning of September 11th. Uncensored radio, and 2 hours in fact became 7 hours, and I'm very grateful not only to Utrice but to Bob Daughtry and to Chevelle Fye, because they have facilitated and made it possible not only for this information to be provided but for us to have Taking Aim on the air, uncensored, uninhibited, in our judgment the quintessence of free speech radio.
The program, the World Trade Centered Uncensored History, was part of the marathon, the fundraising campaign. I don't know if people are aware, it takes approximately $3 million a year to keep WBAI on the air. It's a listener-sponsored station. As you know, we don't have commercials, and we depend upon all of you to keep this station going. If you missed out the opportunity...
This is Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Join us every Friday, 10 a.m. to noon, as we document the role of the U.S. government in instigating and orchestrating the events of September 11th.
Learn how the National Security Agency ran accused hijacker Mohammed Atta and his associates out of South Florida and trained them at U.S. military installations.
Find out how the anthrax planted across the United States has been identified as a weaponized military strain produced exclusively in U.S. government and military laboratories.
See how the pieces of the puzzle fit to form a picture of arbitrary rule in the United States, designed to whip the American people into fear-driven submission to virtual martial law. Taking aim will aid and prepare a fight back against the powerful few who have hijacked our country to advance their profits and to render their power immune to challenge.
Join us Friday, 10 a.m. to noon on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
The view who have received it. We hope you enjoy it. We know that it has much information, and we hope to continue with Taking Aim, providing you even more.
May I also say, Maya, that the uncensored programming that was afforded to us with regard to the events of September 11th included as well the opportunity to discuss my book, The Hidden History of Zionism, and to present a critique and a documentation of the nature of the Zionist movement and of the Israeli state that I have never had the opportunity to do on radio anywhere. I've been interviewed frequently over the many years about these issues, but never have I been given the opportunity to make a sustained presentation on such a subject as that in the United States. I don't have to remind my audience of how difficult it is to provide people with the real data about the colonial nature of and the genocidal character of the Zionist movement's destruction of the Palestinian people. Not only was that programming facilitated, but the microphones were opened up for 4 hours for all comers to take us on, to criticize, to challenge, to dispute data or facts, and it was remarkable programming. I'm grateful for that. I think it's an important contribution.
We would also like to thank the staff, the workers at WBAI, who facilitate the broadcast of this show, the engineers, the unspoken heroes of radio, one of whom is Michael Haskin. I don't know if Michael Haskin is our engineer today, but whoever it is, we really thank you, because you cannot have a radio station without the engineers and also the receptionists and the people who send out the premiums, the volunteers who help. But in particular, the unsung heroes of Pacifica Network, of the various stations, are the actual staff who work at the stations day by day for penurious wages.
And let me say that it's not just the producers who very often volunteer their time who are the bedrock of this kind of programming and broadcasting, but it is the working staff, the people who are the actual creators of a radio station in all its operations, and wages and whose
first
health
of all,
benefits.
Does anybody have an empty chair next to them? Raise your hand. If anybody has an empty chair next to them, please raise your hand. Okay, there are no empty chairs. back over there, there's a chair. Could somebody who's standing up sit in it?
You're listening to WBAI New York. It is 2:48, and we're rejoining the board meeting of the Pacifica National Board that is taking place here in New York City. Stay tuned.
There's actually some food in the other room. Now, I don't want to go overboard. There's not like a lot of food in the other room. There's a little bit of food in the other room. Okay, I really want to thank the people who are voluntarily going into the other room. Could one of the peacekeepers just go in the other room and see how much more room there is over there? Okay, I'm trying to figure out. Okay, folks. We need to get started. We're obviously very, very late. But if I might just take the privilege of the chair for a moment and say that even though I really like to run an orderly meeting and keep things to point and on agenda and on schedule, but to be quite honest, I don't feel too bad that we're running late, because I think we're getting a lot of important work done. And I must say, as someone who's been on the National Board since June of 2000, so far, this is probably the most productive meeting I've been at. Yeah. So, but again, I don't say that to, for self-aggrandizing purposes. I ask you to continue to help us in this venture. And that means that in addition to listening carefully to what people are saying, is to, again, I want to reiterate what I said earlier today, that to try and do whatever you have in your capability to be as respectful to the people who are speaking, be they station managers or people from the listening areas or whatever it might be. Okay, there's still a little more room. Probably 5 or 6 more people could comfortably sit in that room, which actually has windows in it. You actually see sunlight in that room and air. And air. I'm desperate here. So if a few more people could go in that room, that would be great. So again, we, this board, needs the help of every single person in this room. We need the help of every single person in this room to try and let us get through this agenda in an orderly and manner, which means not calling out, not shouting, not jumping up and down, et cetera. And I want to thank everybody for the tremendous way you have been to help so far. So, moving right along, I want to reconvene this meeting. The afternoon session is called to order. There are a number of board people who are not in the room yet, but we assume they will be momentarily. And without any haste here, I'd like to get going. The first order of business is one more station report before we get to BAI, is our Los Angeles station, Southern California station, KPFK. And we'll hear a report from Mark Schub, who is the general manager, and then a report from David Adelson, who is the chair of the lab. Mark, you want to come up to Mike? Thank you, Mark. And again, if everyone could keep the noise down, that would be great. Yep, Mark. Yes. Thank you.
Well, a couple of matters to address before.
Okay, folks, there are two issues when it comes to hearing people. One is that we at the mics need to speak as loudly and clearly as we can. The other is the rest of everybody else needs to be as quiet as you can. Thank you, Mark. Thanks.
Is the mic working?
It should be.
I know how to speak into a microphone. Is it working?
I don't know.
It's not working.
It is working. You just have to be right on it, apparently.
Just a quick thing before I get into my report.
Okay, is there another mic that's better? Let's give him another mic, then.
Please. Okay. Now somebody's turned up the volume. Now you'll be able to hear me. I was speaking into the mic. Could you please step back? You're really being very distracting, and it seems intentional. Thank you. One thing that was mentioned before that I just want to correct quickly, there was some statement to the effect that the Pacifica National Board had always been in Northern California and that it was a Northern California corporation. In fact, it was in Northern California for about 10 years. Before that time, the Pacifica National Office, the Finance Office, and the Archives were all located in Los Angeles. When David Solnicker was hired, he was the man to be the executive director. He was also the manager of KPFA, and at that time, that piece of the office was moved to Berkeley, just for the record. However, if you're thinking of moving them back, we're very happy to have our space, happy to have Pacifica go to Berkeley or wherever it would want. Before I get into my report, too, there was a long discussion about local advisory boards and issues of compliance. And in the board packets of the last meeting, which most of the members of this board were part of the board at its last meeting, there was quite a lot of information of a grievance that's over 2 years pending from the staff of KPFK regarding compliance issues in the local advisory board, where 22 out of 24 staff, after a long process, came to a specific conclusion. It's not my goal to discuss that now or get into it, but I'm wondering where in the agenda will that be addressed? Does the board intend to address the grievance that's been outstanding for over 2 years from the KPFK staff?
Sorry, I didn't hear the question. I was just interrupted, so... Okay.
For more than 2 years, there has been an outstanding grievance related to lab compliance coming from the KPFK staff. Through a long process, lots of correspondence both with the board, investigations from members of the board who were supposed to report back to the board, processes attempting to mediate the differences between the staff and the local advisory board. As a result of all of those processes, there was supposed to be a response to the grievance. Finally, after many years of that grievance being unanswered, at the last board meeting, it was put into the agenda, and the materials were once again, probably for the fourth or fifth time, distributed to the board members, but the agenda, as everyone knows, was tossed out, and there were no meetings to discuss it. I'm wondering, is there going to be some resolution or some process by which the staff's grievance about the local advisory board will be addressed?
That is an important and certainly legitimate question. I'm sorry, and I do, again, take responsibility for this. I did neglect to put this on the agenda for this meeting, and quite a number of people on this board now were not on the board before, so we will have to figure out before the end of the weekend. I don't know if we can address it this weekend, but we will have to figure out how and when we will, and again, I apologize for such a long-standing issue not being attended to.
Well, I appreciate the spirit of the last motion that was passed to try to create dialogue between various factions. It's really completely unfair to expect to jump over this longstanding grievance where the staff has expressed its desire very clearly on this matter and has gone through every appropriate process, never taking their grievance to the air. Always, as long as the rules of this organization were that we had a dirty laundry policy, they've gone through channels, followed the process exactly as it was laid out to us by the organization, and they've just gotten no answer. So I think it's really unfair to be passing motions about changing relationships with the local advisory boards until at least there's some answer to this very properly presented.
Thank you. I don't believe we did that. We passed one resolution related to one lab. We did not pass a resolution related to all the labs. And again, this was precisely why some of us fought very hard to change the nature of this board so we could address those issues. So,
good.
You want to continue? Thank you.
Okay. Well, let me talk about the station status. I'll be talking about finances, I'll be talking about programming, and I'll be talking about broadcast operations. I'd like to start with broadcast operations because without a signal, there's not much of a radio station. KPFK is continuing continues to broadcast at one quarter of its licensed power on an auxiliary transmitter without any backup of any kind. That auxiliary transmitter is in a metal box on our property. There is no remote control of it. It was supposed to be a temporary situation that was going to last no more than 2 to possibly 3 weeks. During those 2 or 3 weeks, it was expected that engineers were installing transmitters nearby the entire time. And it's not a proper broadcast facility, although we've been managing to keep it on the air for several months. We have, as many of you know, raised over $800,000 to entirely replace our transmitter, our antennas, the studio control room, the backup studio control room known as production control, with new digital mixing consoles and a router and brand new equipment from top to bottom, a complete top-down remodel of all the broadcast infrastructure of the radio station, including the facilities at Mount Wilson. That money was in place. Part of that money is a grant from the NTIA PTFP, which is the Public Telecommunications Facilities Program, a federal matching grant. We have certified, or Pacifica, I should say, has certified to the federal government that those matching funds are available to do the project. Some of the money in that $800,000 fund came from targeted donations where donors gave conditional monies. Some of the monies are bequests, and some of the monies came from targeted mailings that said the monies were going to be used for that project. As late as early August, I was assured that everything was okay to proceed with the project, even though 9 months had passed since I'd seen a financial report from the finance office. For the record, every single manager, the entire administrative council, had been pounding the table since February after being understanding for a couple of months that a transition could cause that problem to try to get reports, and none of us have been